So here we are. This is Chapter 7, the first lecture, lecture on the fiscal policies. A lot of this chapter is on specifically the difference between Keynesian ideas and Austrian ideas. We have basically two sets of tools that we have to try to influence economic events. One set of tools are monetary policies, right? Those are policies of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve will either increase or decrease the money supply. If we have inflation, they will attempt to decrease the money supply. If we have unemployment, the Fed will attempt to increase the money supply. And then the other set of tools we have are fiscal policies. Fiscal policies are policies of the federal government. So if we have unemployment, they will use their fiscal policies to try to stimulate the economy. If we have inflation, theoretically, we will use our fiscal policies to restrict the economy. Now, I say theoretically because in actuality, we're not going to use fiscal policies for political reasons to try to bring down inflation. The reason are that cutting spending is politically unpopular, and so much of the federal budget is locked in, and it's very difficult to, if not impossible, to cut certain or the majority of areas. So fiscal policies are more effective at fighting unemployment than they are inflation. And just the opposite, by the way, you know, we've talked about this before, monetary policies are better at fighting inflation than they are unemployment. Now, why are not monetary policies effective at fighting unemployment? Anybody? I know we've talked about this before. Why are monetary policies, policies of the Federal Reserve, non-effective at fighting unemployment? Because the Federal Reserve can make it easier for people to borrow money, but they can't force people to borrow money. You know, the Federal Reserve can take action to make banks more liquid because, you know, we've already talked about the real influence that the Federal Reserve has is to influence the liquidity of banks. So if we have unemployment, the Federal Reserve will take action to make banks more liquid. And as a result, interest rates may come down, but there are lots of reasons why people won't run to the bank and borrow money just because money's easier to borrow or interest rates are lower. You know, are unemployed people going to run the bank and borrow money to buy a new car just because interest rates are lower? Or if people even fear that they may become unemployed, are they going to run to the bank and borrow money for whatever, to buy a new car, just because interest rates are lower? See, there's lots of reasons why people will not go to the bank and borrow money despite the fact that money is easier to borrow in the loanable funds market. But the opposite is true with inflation. The Fed is very good at fighting inflation because if demand is at a certain level and the Federal Reserve takes actions to make banks less liquid, so banks have less money available to lend out, and they do lend out less money, then demand will come down and eventually prices will come down. Okay, so that's the overview of, you know, fiscal policies versus monetary policy. So in this chapter, we're going to go more into the specifics of fiscal policies, you know, those policies of the federal government. So first of all, who were the classical economists? A group of the 18th and 19th centuries, including Adam Smith, known as the father of modern-day economics. And we've talked about Adam Smith before. He had a book published in 1776 called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And Adam Smith is known as the father of modern-day economics because he was the first one to really put everything together and explain why it is that in a free market system with no central authority, the system seems to produce those things that consumers want and at reasonable prices. And So the classical economists were a group that came after or included Adam Smith and came after Adam Smith in the 18th and 19th century, looking at the economy as a self-adjusting mechanism, which we'll explain here. I'll explain in just a minute. But I've got to put this thing in slideshow mode. Let me see from the beginning. Okay. What did Adam Smith and the classical economists believe? The economy is always tending toward a full employment equilibrium and stable prices. Now, this is really the heart and core of the difference between Keynesian economics and Austrian economics. Okay? The classical economists were really much more akin to Austrian thought than Keynesian thought. Okay? So, what does the concept of equilibrium mean in economics, first of all? What is the
economy tends to be?
Yeah, right. The key word there is tends to. Exactly right. The equilibrium is the point toward which the economy tends. So the classical economists, and this would include Austrians, you know, present-day Austrians, they believe that if you have a free market economy, that the economy will tend toward a point of full employment. All right? Now, if you believe that the economy is tending toward a point of full employment, then you will be less likely to favor government programs. Right? I mean, if the economy is always tending toward a point of full employment, then if you simply are patient, then the economy will adjust itself and pretty soon get back to full employment. So there's less need for government involvement. All right? Again, this is, you know, the Austrian view. Now, what does laissez-faire mean? It's a French term which means leave well enough alone, allow them to do, let the economy correct problems itself. Laissez-faire goes along with the ideas of Austrians and that the economy is, again, a free market economy. Now, do we have a free market economy today in America? No, we don't. The majority of our economy is not free enterprise at all. So we're not really talking about the American economy as it exists today. But what we're saying is that in a free market economy where the market determines the production of goods and service, then laissez-faire means, well, if you just leave that system alone, yes, you're going to have ups and downs. Just like you and I breathe in and breathe out, the economy is going to get better, it's going to get worse. Your recessions are just as part of life as periods of prosperity. Recessions are inevitable. Again, this is according to Austrian thought. So because recessions are inevitable and it's just a natural flow of economic events, then the thinking is to practice laissez-faire. So you leave the economy alone. It'll adjust itself back to full employment. See, now what happened in the Depression of 1921? Even though it was serious, the government practiced laissez-faire and the economy recovered in a short period of time. The Depression of 1921 was severe, and the authorities did not take action, and it was not long before the economy corrected itself. So a lot of Austrian economists look at the Depression of 1921 and they say, well, see, you know, here's a historical example of what happens if the economy does go into a serious downturn. If you practice laissez-faire, the economy is going to adjust itself and eventually we're going to get to full employment. See, without a lot of government involvement. What were the policies of President Herbert Hoover in the early 30s to combat the Depression? Now, we're talking about the Depression of the 1930s, you know, the Great Depression, which lasted essentially from 1929 to 1939. Although that's a gross generalization. Actually, we had two depressions during those years, but most people look at the 30s and say, well, that's the, you know, the Great Depression. So what did Herbert Hoover do? Herbert Hoover was president before Franklin Roosevelt. Herbert Hoover was president in 1929 when the Depression started, it was Franklin Roosevelt who campaigned against Herbert Hoover. Franklin Roosevelt didn't become president until January of 1933. So what did Herbert Hoover advocate? Public works projects. He raised taxes. He made loans to failing firms. And he instituted a lot of relief programs. All of which, or at least most of which, Franklin Roosevelt campaigned against. Now, what we're going to learn, however, is that when Franklin Roosevelt became president, he did exactly the same things. He furthered public works project, raised taxes, made loans to failing firms, and had a whole slew of relief programs. In fact, we call the package the New Deal. The New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt were all these programs that were instituted after he became president. But in his campaign, he actually campaigned against these policies of Herbert Hoover. So what were the policies of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to combat the Depression? Public works projects, social welfare programs, raise taxes and wages, loans to failing firms. So a lot of people don't realize how this works. You know, a lot of people, historians, believe that, you know, Herbert Hoover was against any government involvement at all, but that's not the case. So according to Robert Reich, an American political economist and professor, what was the result of these government programs? These programs helped save American capitalism. Now, is Robert Reich a Keynesian or an Austrian? Come on now, it should be obvious.
Keynesian?
Yeah, it's obvious that he's a Keynesian. See, I mean, if he supports all these government programs, you know, welfare programs and other programs, and if he's in favor of government intervening, then, you know, that's the Keynesian way of thinking. And the belief of the Keynesians is that if it weren't for Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal programs, that America would have slipped right into communism. Now, communism was a pretty strong movement in America back in the 30s. I mean, there were whole, you know, groups, there were political parties that were communistic, and because things got real bad, people were looking for something to save them. And see, you know the unemployment rate in the 1930s was 25%, and that doesn't mean that the other 75% of the workforce was doing well, because wages went down. And in fact, one of the problems during the Great Depression is people quitting their jobs. Now, why would someone quit a job during the Great Depression? And the answer is they weren't making enough money to keep body and soul together, because wages went down so much. So in that situation of unemployment and falling wages and tremendous decline in standards of living, of course, people were looking for an answer, something to save them. And that something in the minds of a lot of people was communism. So the Keynesian economists say, well, Roosevelt came in like a knight on a, you know, riding on a big white horse, and he came in with all these government programs, and he saved America from communism. So he saved our democratic institutions. Now, again, this is Keynesian. Now, Austrians don't think that way. In fact, Austrians think the opposite. See, according to Thomas Woods, author of Meltdown, which is one of the books I highlight, in your textbook, what was the result of these government programs, meaning the New Deal programs for Franklin Roosevelt during the 30s. These programs prevented the economy from seeking its equilibrium of full employment and prolonged the Depression. Now, do you see two completely different viewpoints here? All right? And that's really the thrust of this textbook. You know, there are two different viewpoints. Keynesians think one way, Austrians think another way. Now, which way of thinking, by the way, is prevalent today in our government? Keynesian or Austrian?
Keynesian.
And what's one of the reasons why Keynesian economics is so popular amongst politicians?
Because Keynesians support government.
And government programs, right? See? But if politicians supported Austrian economics, well, that would mean, well, less government, let the economy adjust itself, and so politicians would be less important, right? Where if you're a Keynesian and you believe that we need government intervention, well, that makes politicians more important. So most politicians are Keynesians, okay? Now, the only Austrians, well, you do have Austrians both in the House and the Senate, but they are very much in the minority. Okay. See, what is a fiscal policy? The manipulation of government purchases, transfer payments, taxes, and borrowing in order to positively influence the economy. Okay, so we already talked about fiscal policies. Government purchases, transfer payment. What's a transfer payment? A transfer payment is when the government takes from this group and gives it to this group over here. You know, it's like Social Security or welfare. You know, the government taxes and then takes people money from some people and gives it to, sometimes it's other people, sometimes it could be the same people. I mean, people who pay taxes also receive government benefits. So it's not, you know, those who have to those who don't have strictly, but it's that process of taxing and then taking the money and putting it back in over here, you know, as opposed to government spending money on national defense, for example. See, if it spent money in national defense, that's not a transfer payment. Or if it spends money building roads, that's not a transfer payment. But when it simply takes money out of the pocket of this person and puts it into the pocket of this other person, that's what's called a transfer payment. And a good deal of our national budget is in the form of transfer payments. In fact, the vast majority of our federal budget is in the form of transfer payments, which is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to cut government spending. Because if the majority of your spending is in the form of transfer payments and then you cut spending, well, you're taking money out of the pockets of people who are in need. And that's a difficult thing to do politically, especially since we live in a democracy. See, what's one of the dangers of a pure democracy?
It wouldn't be able to speak for themselves?
No, in a pure democracy, you would have
minority.
Yes, exactly. And the danger of a pure democracy is that the majority can take everything away from the minority. Okay. Now, what is a republic?
Republic gives the minority more say so.
And in what form? Because
checks and balances.
And checks and balances. Right. It's an example of laws. all those things that you said, you know, are laws. You know, a republic is a system based on law. And as he said over there, the purpose of many of these laws is to protect the minority from the majority. See, we've got a pure democracy. Well, anyone who's in any group that's in the majority can simply vote everything away from the minority, and the minority has no recourse, no power. But if you have a republic based on law, and many of those laws are designed to protect the minority from the majority, see, that's the kind of system we have in America. See? So, anyway, that manipulation of government purchase, transfer payments, taxes, and borrowing in order to positively influence the economy. And notice that I do have the word here, influence. You know, in a lot of textbooks, you would see the word control. But the government and the Federal Reserve does not control economic events. They can influence economic events. But the economic system is bigger than both government and the Federal Reserve. How did Keynes influence fiscal policies? He argued that fiscal policies may be necessary to bring about full employment. And notice here I say may. I didn't say can. And this is the big difference between Keynes and Keynesians. Right? If Keynes were alive today, he probably would not be a Keynesian. Because there's a difference between what Keynes advocated in his book, The General Theory, and what Keynesians advocate today in his name. The difference, there's an analogy I like to use to explain that difference. And the difference is, let's suppose you're sick, and so you go to the doctor. And the doctor takes your temperature and evaluates, you know, gives you an exam, and he says, well, this is what's wrong. Here is medicine. Take it 3 times a day. Get lots of rest. Drink lots of water. And if you don't feel better in a week, you know, give me a call. And then you go home. Right? Well, that is John Maynard Keynes. Now, here's the Keynesians. The Keynesians is you're sick. You go to the doctor gives you a medical exam, he says this and that's wrong with you, here's some medicine, but in order for you to really get well, I'm going to have to monitor you 24 hours a day. Now, in order for me to monitor you 24 hours a day to make sure that you do the right things, I'm going to have to move in with you. And, oh, by the way, I've got a wife and, you know, 7 children. I expect to be well taken care of, and so maybe you're going to have to build a couple rooms onto your house in order to accommodate this doctor and his family who's going to move in full time. Now, do y'all get the analogy there? Those are the modern Keynesians. See, if you look at government policy today, that's what you find. You find the attitude that, well, if things are going to work right, we need continual government involvement. See, that's not Keynes. It's Keynesian idea. All right? How did World War II affect fiscal policies? It showed that a government stimulus package can work. Now, again, you know, the Keynesians look at the Great Depression. They say, well, Roosevelt did a good thing, but he didn't do enough. You know, there wasn't enough government stimulus. But the war, World War II, you know, which we entered, like, I think it was 1941, or maybe 42, that stimulated aggregate demand so that by 1945, we had reached full employment. So the Keynesians look at that and say, ha, there, you see, there's a historic proof that massive government stimulus will bring a moribund economy back to full employment. Now, the Austrians don't think that way, don't believe that, but that's a, you know, that's what, you know, Keynesians would think. So what is the Employment Act of 1946? Its main purpose was to lay responsibility of economic stability of inflation and unemployment onto the federal government. Now, during the 30s, under Franklin Roosevelt, you did have a lot of government involvement, but what Roosevelt did was not official. I mean, it wasn't written down anywhere. It wasn't written down saying, oh, well, this is the responsibility of government. I mean, he just did it. So what the Act of 1946, the reason that's important is that this was the first time that we actually wrote down, we said, oh, well, you know, other than the government providing us with a national defense and providing a uniform system of weights and measures and providing us with these other laws, in addition to all these things, it's also the responsibility of government to make sure, or it takes action to ensure full employment and stable prices. Okay? Now that, of course, is strictly a Keynesian way of thinking. Now, what are the four phases of the business cycle? Every economy goes through four phases. We have a trough, recovery, a peak, and a recession. A trough is the bottom of the business cycle when you have lots of unemployment. But eventually something's going to happen that's going to spur on a recovery. So the economy starts to move upward, and after a while it reaches what's called a peak. Now that peak may be short-lived, maybe months, or it could be long, it could be years. But something's going to happen that it's going to push us back down where you're going to have growing unemployment. We're going to go back into recession, but eventually we reach a trough, and this trough is either going to be short-lived or long-lived. Could be relatively minor or very serious, like the Great Depression of the 30s. But eventually something's going to happen, and so this is what's called the business cycle. Okay? So what is a liquidity trap? Now, this is a very key concept. If I asked you, why does Keynesian economics make sense? There's a couple good reasons. I mean, even for an Austrian. And just a couple. And one is what economists call a liquidity trap. Now, what influence does the Federal Reserve have over banks? What can the Federal Reserve do to influence banks? Remember, we talked about this over there in Dublin?
Sell bonds?
Yeah, but why is it sell bonds? What's it doing?
Making the bank more liquid?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. What the influence that the Fed has on banks is liquidity. The Federal Reserve can take action to make banks either more liquid or less liquid. Of course, if we're okay. He told me, by the way, he had to leave early, so I really appreciate this. You know, if you got to leave early, I appreciate you telling me. I got someone else who's going to leave, right, pretty soon, they told me. But anyway, a liquidity trap is just what it says. Everything else being equal, our economy will be healthy if there is a healthy circular flow of money. Now, money in the economy is just like blood in our bodies. Do y'all know how that works? You know, our heart pumps blood into our lung area. There it picks up oxygen. Then it goes in the intestinal area. There blood cells pick up nutrients. And then it distributes those nutrients and oxygen to different cells of the body. But eventually it becomes depleted of nutrients and oxygen. And then it begins its journey back to the heart, which then it's pumped to the lung area, the intestinal area, and round, round, round she goes. And that's what makes life possible. Now, if that flow of blood speeds up too much, what happens? What happens to you if the flow of blood speeds up too much? What do we call that? What? Yeah, that can lead to a heart attack, but before a heart attack,
it's blood pressure.
Yeah, blood pressure. It causes a high blood pressure. And if your blood pressure remains high for a long, you know, for a certain period of time, it could lead to a heart attack. All right? But now, if the circular flow of blood is too slow, what happens? Come on, what happens to your body if the circular, if the blood circulates too slowly?
You don't get the oxygen.
And what's the physical result?
Pass out.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, you would eventually pass out. You become anemic. You become very slow. It's you lose your energy, and you know your body is just winding down, and eventually you could die if your blood pressure remains low enough. So in order for us to be healthy physically, our blood has to circulate within a certain healthy range. Well, that's exactly what money is in the economy. Money, see, first of all, the economy is not bricks and mortar, but it's flesh and blood. The economy is people. People make up the economy, not things. And so since the economy is biological, then it has a circulatory system. Now, that circulatory system is made up of money. All right? Now, what is the heart in our modern economy? Come on, it should be obvious. What's the heart?
The business.
No. Take another guess.
People?
No.
Banks.
Banks are that the heart. See, what happens is that people earn money and then they put money into banks. And what do banks do? Well, they lend that money out. Right? They lend the money out. People borrow money. They buy new cars. They buy houses. Business borrows it to make investments. That grows the economy. Now we got jobs. People are paid an income, a wage. They spend most of it maybe, but they save a part of it. They put money in the bank. The bank lends that money out. And some of that money, by the way, that goes in the banks may not be just savings, but we're also including money that you might put into a checking account. You know, you put money in and then you write checks against it. But whichever way it is, whether it's savings or you put money in a checking account, money goes in the banks and then it comes back out. Money goes in the banks and then it goes back out. And as long as that circular flow is healthy, then everything else being equal, the economy stays healthy. Now, when I say everything else being equal, that's like you go to the doctor and the doctor says, man, you're in perfect health, you'll live forever. And you walk out of the doctor's office and get hit by a Mack truck. I mean, you know, what we're saying here is everything else being equal, as long as there's a healthy circular flow, the economy will stay healthy. Now, what a liquidity trap is that money goes into these savings institutions, but not enough of it comes back out. It gets locked up, not all of it, but a lot of it gets locked up in banks. And Keynes called this a liquidity trap. See? The money is trapped in banks. And it's banks stay liquid because they can't get rid of enough money. You know, they're not lending out enough of their excess reserves. Okay? So, of course, this is going to happen during periods of unemployment because, there are lots of reasons why, people won't borrow more money if they're unemployed, but why do investors borrow money? Well, investors borrow money when they expect their return on investment to be greater than what they have to pay to borrow money. See, it's all based on expectations. If investors look into the future and they say, well, I can borrow X amount of money and I can invest in this and that project and I expect my return to be so much and my return is going to be greater than what I have to pay to borrow the money or greater than the principal of money I borrowed, then, well, I'm going to gain if I borrow money. But notice that it's all hinges on expectations. It's not the here and the now, but it's expectations. So if we have unemployment and things are going south economically, well, what happens to expectations in the hearts and the minds of investors? Well, investors become more pessimistic. And because they're more fearful of the future, well, despite the fact that money is easier to come by in the loanable funds market, they may not run to the bank and borrow more money. So if the consumers aren't going to borrow enough money, if investors aren't going to borrow enough money, then we end up with a liquidity trap. And what that is like it's a low blood pressure. You know, it's like a person's got low blood pressure. The blood is slowing down. It's not circulating fast enough. So, what's the solution? Anybody? What's the solution? But first of all, what's the problem? The problem is the liquidity trap. The problem is more money's going in the banks, but not enough is coming back out. Well, how come not enough is coming back out? Because consumers and investors aren't borrowing enough money. So what is the solution? How do we correct or reverse a liquidity trap? Well, no, we've already done that. The Federal Reserve has taken action to lower interest rates. But despite those lower interest rates, consumers and businesses, not enough of them are going to banks to borrow the money. So, what would a solution be? Somebody ought to think about this. I mean, it's in light of what we've talked about, it's...
Buy one, get one free.
Buy one. Well, again, you're saying, okay, we're going to make it easier for people. We're going to make it easier. We can give people more incentive to borrow money. But what I'm saying is that that's not working. See, in a liquidity trap, those policies aren't working. But there is a solution that Keynes advocated.
Employ more people.
Well, but we gotta stimulate the flow of money before we get more employment. I mean, it's the lack of money circulation that's causing the unemployment. Guess I have to give you the answer, right? The answer is government has to go and borrow the money. See how that works? I mean, if consumers aren't going to borrow enough, if investors aren't going to borrow enough, well, by gosh, the government can go in there and borrow the money. Then what does the government do? Well, the government injects the economy, injects the money into the economy through one transfer payment program or another. Now we're putting money into the hands of people. See, we've taken it out of banks, putting it in the hands of people. Now what's going to happen to demand? Well, people got more money. Consumers will demand more. With consumers demanding more, business is going to sell more. We get an increase in investments. And so what happens to the circular flow of money? Well, it revives. Now, I would guess that even an Austrian would see the validity in that. Okay? I mean, even if you ask an Austrian, well, you know, what are some good aspects of Keynesian economics? Then one aspect would be that government can solve the problem of a liquidity trap. All right? See, what is the Keynesian solution to liquidity trap? Okay, government borrows the money that consumers and business do not borrow. All right, we just talked about that. This was really the a very essential aspect of Keynes' general theory of employment, interest, and money, you know, published in 1936. Now, how does crowding out? What does crowding out mean? During periods of full employment, the government can borrow money that otherwise would be spent or invested. Now, maybe the flip side of a liquidity trap is, okay, what happens if the government borrows too much? You know, oftentimes the extremes of anything is not a good thing. I mean, would you rather take a bath in ice water or boiling water? Well, either way would be unpleasant, correct? I mean, the extremes of almost anything aren't very good. Well, same with, you know, this concept of the circular flow of money and the liquidity trap. You know, yes, okay, you got a liquidity trap. What's the solution? Government borrows the money, injects it into the economy. But what happens if the government goes overboard and borrows too much money? Well, then the opposite occurs. What can happen is that the government can crowd out you and I as consumers and business from the loanable funds market. Now, the loanable funds market, by the way, is, I've talked about before, you know, that's the market that when you go to the bank to borrow money, you're demanding money. That's what we mean by the demand for money. You go to the bank and you want to take out a loan. You're the demander. The bank is the supplier. So you got a demander and a supplier for something. And so in this case, that something is money. So we call that market the loanable funds market. All right? Now, if the government borrows too much money from that loanable funds market, then there may not be enough money for you and I to borrow or for investors to borrow, you know, businesses particularly to borrow. And if there's not enough money available for demanders, like consumers, or investors, like business, then business will invest less, consumers will spend less, and we could have an adverse effect on the economy. Now, it's true that if the government borrows that money, where they're going to inject that money back into the economy. But what's the difference between the government having a dollar and you and I spending that dollar, or investors investing that dollar? Well, history shows us that when private investors make investments, those investments are more efficient than when government makes investments. Remember the video I showed you about the ghost cities in China? Remember that? And there were, you know, there's several, you know, I don't know how many there are, four, five, six huge cities in China with no one living in the cities. Why? Because it was government that decided to build these cities according to their master plan, but they weren't built in a place and in such a way that people could use them. See, in other words, government spending oftentimes is very inefficient. All right? So, So what crowding out does is, see, when the government borrows too much money, well, yeah, they take the money and they may inject it back in the economy, but history has shown us that they're not going to be as efficient at that in terms of economic growth as if, you know, consumers and investors were doing it. Okay? Of course, the reason is very simple. I mean, what is the motivation of government spending money? Now, if government spends money, who is it that's spending? It's politicians who are spending the money. Well, what's the problem here? Well, we're spending tax dollars. It could be, of course, now we're talking about borrowing, but it could be tax dollars. But what's the problem with politicians spending money? See, what we're talking about here is economic growth. You know, what we're talking about is having an economy that's got some vitality to it, a growing, dynamic economy. What's the problem with government spending money? The key word there is politicians. Come on now. What's the motivation? The motivation is political. Politicians spend money for political reasons, right? See, do investors invest money for political reasons? No, they don't. They invest money to make a profit, right? They invest money. If they make bad choices, well, they're penalized with losses. If they make good choices, they're rewarded with profit. But their motivation is to make a profit, and if enough of them make good decisions, that grows the economy. But not so when government spends the money. Government spends the money primarily for political reasons. Okay? So this is why crowding out can be a problem. If the government, again, this is the opposite of a liquidity trap. If the government borrows too much money, then that money may be spent unwisely. It may not be spent in ways that will best grow the economy. And so as a result, the economy begins to shrink. It becomes unproductive. Anyway, that's the concept of crowding out, which is one of the reasons why Austrians are against big government. You know, Austrians say, well, you know, if government's too big and they borrow too much money, they crowd out consumers, investors from the loanable funds market, and that has got bad implications because it leads to a slowdown in economic activity. Now, of course, would a Keynesian believe that? Well, probably not. See, a Keynesian would say, well, oh, no, you got it all wrong. I mean, we got these politicians, and they're, these are good people, and they're wise, and, they've got a bunch of, they have, understanding of how things work, and so they're going to spend money in such a way that's going to grow the economy. Now, that's the Keynesian. Again, there are two different ways of thinking here, okay? Keynesian, Austrian, very different. How does the government borrow money? Well, we've talked about this before, of course. They sell bonds, which we call securities. Why do we call bonds securities? Anybody know? Has the government ever defaulted on a loan? No. So if you buy a bond, is that a secure place to put your money? Yes. So we call these bonds securities. See how that works? So every penny the government has ever borrowed is from the sale of a bond. And these bonds can be sold to the Federal Reserve, or these bonds can be sold in the open market. You know, just like the stock market is a place where stocks are bought and sold, the open market is a place where bonds are bought and sold. And remember, see, if you buy a bond and that bond doesn't mature for another 20 years, see, that bond's got a face value. And whatever the face value is, that's what you're going to get 20 years from now. And, of course, you don't pay the face value originally. You pay something much less than the face value. In fact, the way savings bonds work is that you pay half the face value. And the savings bond is worth X number of dollars at a certain future date. Okay? So if you buy a bond that doesn't mature for another 20 years, but after 5 years you say, well, I don't want to wait for another 15 years. I want my money. Can you sell that bond to someone else? Yes. Now, what's going to determine how much money that person will pay you for the bond? You got a bond, 20-year bond, 5 years goes by, you want to sell it. You go to the open market to find a potential purchaser. What's going to decide what price you're going to sell that bond for? Now, you're selling the bond in the open market. What's going to determine how much you're going to sell the bond for?
Well, how much is matured?
Well, all those are factors, availability and maturity, but you're selling the bond in the open market. So what determines the price? Well, yeah, that's true, and we call that the market, right? What's the market? Demand and supply, right? You're going to sell the bond to the highest bidder. See, it's a bidding process. Now, if someone buys your bond, and maybe they keep it for 5 years, but now we got another 10 years before the bond matures. Can they sell the bond to somebody? Yes. What's going to determine the price they can sell the bond for? The market. See how that works? And while I'm on this subject, you know, sometimes I've got to repeat myself. And I think this is one of those cases where, you know, I'll just have to repeat myself. But when interest rates goes down, what happens to bond prices? They go down, they go up. Well, which is it? Now, think about that logically. All right? You've got a bond to sell. And interest rates are going down. Now, what happens to your bargaining position in the market? Well, your bargaining position is better because, you know, people can't get a good return elsewhere. You know, interest rates are low. All right? So you can sell your bond at a high price because people can't go elsewhere and get a better deal. But now what happens when interest rates in the market's rising? Well, you as the seller of the bond are in a less favorable position. See, people can't go elsewhere so easily and get a better return. Okay? So this puts you in a better bargaining position, and you can raise the price of your bond. So when interest rates, When interest rates go, I'm talking about the price of the bond. When interest rates goes up, the price of the bond go down, right? Because if interest rates are going up, well, you've got to say, oh, well, now, how am I going to convince those people not to go over there and get those higher interest rates, but to come to me and buy my bond? Well, you're going to have to, like in any market, lower your price. See how that works? So interest rates and bond prices move in opposite directions. Interest rates goes up, bond prices go down. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Now, when we say bond prices, what are we talking about? What we're talking about are prices of bonds that, you know, they may have been bought in the past, but their maturity date hasn't come yet. And so, you know, these bonds are being bought and sold in the market. And so how much money can people get for these bonds? Well, that you got this inverse relationship between bond prices and interest rates. Now, that doesn't exactly tie in with the subject, but it does tie in with understanding basic economics, all right? And that's really why you're here, right? To hopefully understand how the world works. See, notice here when I say there's an inverse relationship between bond price and interest rates, is that something that, you know, somebody passed a law making that so? No, that's a law like the law of gravity, right? It's not a man-made law. It's a natural law. It's nothing else can happen. At least in a free market. Now, of course, you can have government that may force things in directions that would be different than a free market. But we're talking here about a free market. And what is the current national debt? Now, I've even showed you the debt clock before. What?
$17 billion.
Not billion, but
trillion.
Yeah, it's over. I think the latest was pretty close to $17.5 trillion. How much was our national debt in 2010? I'm not sure if I got my facts right. 2010. That, maybe it's 2000. I'm going to play it safe here and say year 2000. But in year 2000, it was about $10 trillion. Could be 2010, but I'm not sure. But anyway, the whole point is that the national debt has increased a whole lot in just, you know, recent years. And, you know, what I try to do in the textbook is I try not to give you lots of facts and figures. You know, I try to give you general statements like, you know, the national debt has doubled, you know, in the recent past, because it's hard to remember specific facts. Anyway, $17.5 trillion, and if you click on this, you would go to the debt clock, which we've been to before, you know, which shows you, for example, that the household debt is somewhere around 140,000. So in other words, the average household, their share of the federal debt is about $140,000. But that, I'm going by memory here, and I could be off. Now, what does monetizing the debt mean? And we talked about this before. We're talking about government borrowing. How does the government borrow money? By selling bonds. Who can buy the bonds? Well, they can sell the bonds in the open market where anybody can buy them, or they can sell the bonds to the Federal Reserve. Now, when the Federal Reserve creates the money to buy the bonds, we call that monetizing the debt. But when the national debt increased so much and the Federal Reserve was so busy creating money, in fact, for 4 years, it created about $85 billion a month to buy federal, you know, bond, to buy bonds. Now, what does that word create mean? You know, this is a word that's misused in our society, but what does the word create mean? If you looked up in the dictionary, it means to make something from nothing. That's what create means. So the Federal Reserve can create money. They can make money from nothing. Now the federal government has sold bonds to the Federal Reserve over the past 5 or 6 years, and the Federal Reserve, I mean monthly, and the Federal Reserve has created billions of dollars a month to buy these government securities. But that practice became unpopular, so what did the government do? I mentioned this before, which tells you something about government. Well, they simply changed the name. So what's the modern term for monetizing the debt? Anybody know that? Anybody over there in Dublin? Well, the modern term is quantitative easing. Okay, it's the same thing, but it's a different term, so it's politically, you know, not as damaging as monetizing the debt. What can monetizing the debt lead to? A fall in the value of the dollar and inflation. See, what causes inflation? Now, the very simple explanation is too much money chasing too few goods. So when we monetize a debt or practice quantitative easing, we're creating new money, putting that in circulation. The money supply increases more than goods and services increase, and that's what causes inflation. Now, why is that not caused inflation today? I mean, in the recent past? Well, we'll talk about that, you know, next time. So I'll see you all next time.